William. But William is adamant that he's not going to give England to Robert. England goes to the second son, William Rufus. And as soon as the dying king gives Rufus the okay to inherit England, Rufus leaves his father, heads straight for England, the idea being that he wants to head off any disturbances that might break out when news of the king's death becomes known. And finally, there's Henry. There's no land left over, so all Henry gets is 5,000 pounds of silver. But Henry's very smart with the money. He uses it to buy land from his brother Robert in western Normandy, and he busily sets about building up a base of support there. Henry's also the only brother present at the funeral of William the Conqueror, which was a very sorry affair indeed. Apparently, the king's coffin was too short and narrow for his body, his rather corpulent body. And when his attendants tried to squeeze it into the coffin, the king's bowels burst open, releasing an extremely unpleasant smell. So that is the rather undignified end of William the Conqueror. And he left problems behind him simply because of this decision to divide up his lands between his two older sons. By this point, many families have lands both in Normandy and in England. These are people who have gotten grants of land in England, but they still have their lands in Normandy too. And it's very awkward to owe allegiance to Robert in Normandy and William Rufus in England. And throughout William Rufus's time as king, he's king of England for 13 years, there are efforts by the barons in England to try to get England for Robert. And conversely, William is always causing trouble for Robert in Normandy by interfering with his barons there. Now, throughout this period, in the late 1080s and 1090s, Henry, the youngest brother, is flitting back and forth between the two brothers, supporting whichever one is going to give him a better deal at that moment. It's a very dysfunctional trio of siblings. And if we believe some of the stories, the bad feeling between them goes all the way back to their childhoods. Now, one incident is especially telling. If true, it could be simply gossip. One day in 1077, when William the Conqueror is campaigning in southern Normandy, he's got his three sons in tow, Robert, the oldest, is entertaining his friends in their lodging. William Rufus and Henry, they're on the upper floor. And Rufus and Henry are said to have thrown a wild party upstairs, and they top it all off by urinating on their older brother and his guests from the second floor of the lodging, sort of off the balcony. So it's not any wonder that they don't get along. But let me tell you about one deal that two of them struck that might seem rather amazing. And it shows, I think, how powerful a force the Crusades were in medieval life. In 1095, Pope Urban II preaches a crusade against the Turks. All over Europe, men take the cross, and one of them is Robert, Duke of Normandy. Now, he doesn't have any money to go on crusade. Normandy is not nearly as rich as England. So he actually mortgages the Duchy of Normandy to his brother William, the King of England, to raise the money for the trip. Consider the fact that for years these brothers have been fighting against each other, each of them trying to reunite the lands that their father had held. Now, Robert hands over Normandy and leaves for Jerusalem. Now, Robert does indeed make it to Jerusalem, and he has, on the whole, a pretty good experience on the crusade. He's not in the absolute top rank of famous crusading heroes, but he's solidly in the second tier. But when he comes back to his lands to reclaim them from his brother, he finds it's a different brother on the throne of England. Henry is now king instead of William Rufus. What had happened? First, let me say a couple of general words about William Rufus as king before we talk about how he died. Rufus was a divisive figure. On the whole, his nobles liked him, churchmen didn't. His court was criticized for its extremely loose morals. Now, William Rufus never married, and since some commentators at the time accuse his courtiers of being effeminate, many people have concluded that William Rufus was a homosexual. I don't think we know one way or the other. All we know for sure is William is not a pious man, and he loved a good time. And he got into a famous conflict with his Archbishop of Canterbury, St. Anselm, and this led to the Archbishop going into exile for several years. Rufus didn't miss him, and he cheerfully took the chance to confiscate the revenues of the Archbishop while he was out of the country. And incidentally, he did this whenever a bishop died. He would put off naming a new bishop as long as he possibly could, because in the meantime, he could collect the revenues of the see. He would leave some sees vacant as long as 4 years and just rake in the money. Still, he doesn't seem to have been widely hated by anybody other than churchmen, and it was a great shock when he died suddenly in August of the year 1100. And the circumstances were just the kind to give rise to conspiracy theories. And in fact, if you have to name the top unsolved mystery of medieval English history, the runner-up would probably be what really happened when William Rufus died. The winner would be who killed the princes in the Tower under Richard III, but we're going to get to that later in the course. So back to 1100. Rufus is out hunting in the New Forest in southern England. This is one of the official forest areas that I talked about in the last lecture. And a bolt from the crossbow of one of his companions, a man named Walter Tyrrell, strikes the king, and he dies right there in the forest. Now, the guy who shoots the crossbow bolt, Walter Tyrrell, he gets out of there as fast as he possibly can. Many people have assumed that the king's brother Henry was involved in the death in some way. And as we'll see, Henry does seize the throne immediately after Rufus died, so he is the one who benefits. Other people have tried to put Tyrrell at the web of some sort of very complicated international conspiracy to murder the king. These are ingenious theories. I'm not going to go into detail about them. I believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. I believe Walter Tyrrell shot William Rufus by accident. There's no hard evidence of anybody's guilt, and hunting accidents were extremely common. William Rufus had lost a brother early in life to a hunting accident. The Conqueror had originally had 4 sons, not just 3. One of them had died. And just that spring, in 1100, a few months earlier, Robert Curthose's illegitimate son had died in a hunting accident in Normandy. So I think we can just let William Rufus rest in peace, secure in the knowledge that he simply fell victim to a rather ridiculous accident. But what an opportunity then presented itself to young Henry. He was with his brother on the day he died. He was the man on the spot, and we've seen before how important that could be. And Henry had his wits about him. The accident took place on a Thursday. The New Forest, where the accident took place, is about 14 or so miles from Winchester, the seat of the royal treasury. As soon as Henry had inspected the body, verified that his brother was dead, he left instructions about the transport of the body, hurried straight to Winchester, and seized the treasury. So now he's got all the money. The next morning, William Rufus is solemnly buried in Winchester Cathedral with Henry piously in attendance. London is about 50 miles from Winchester. By Saturday, Henry is in London, and on Sunday, he's crowned in Westminster Abbey. The man on the spot is now king. Now, meanwhile, Robert Curthose is on his way back from the Crusade. He arrives back in Normandy in September, and he discovers once again he's been shut out of the succession to the English throne. The one saving grace for Robert is that William Rufus's death had canceled the mortgage agreement between the two brothers. Robert didn't need to repay the loan. But Henry had come to the throne under very difficult circumstances, to say the least, and he did have this famous crusader brother staring across the channel at him, and he seems to have made some very prudent moves to shore up his support. He issued a so-called Charter of Liberties to the English Church, claiming that he was going to respect the rights of the Church, and he had copies sent to every English shire. This is a very effective piece of early royal propaganda. And he also took steps immediately to get married, and he even completed very difficult negotiations with the exiled Archbishop of Canterbury, St. Anselm, so that the Archbishop could come home and perform the wedding ceremony. And Henry chose his wife, as we saw in the last lecture, a woman who was descended from the House of Wessex, the legitimate royal family of England, very much to make his English subjects happy. Now, her original name is Princess Edith. She's the daughter of Queen Margaret of Scotland, who was herself the granddaughter of Edmund Ironside. And once they're married, Edith takes the name Matilda, because it's just easier for the Normans to cope with the name Matilda. It seems as if almost every important Norman woman in this whole period is named Matilda. Henry seems to have liked English women, though he likes women in general. He had many mistresses, and he seems to have treated them rather well on the whole. He also has the highest total number of acknowledged illegitimate children in English royal history, 21. That beats the runner-up, Charles II, with 14, and he was called the Merry Monarch. Now, this doesn't mean that Henry is necessarily a soft-hearted man. He could be incredibly ruthless. Back in 1090, when he was briefly on good terms with his brother Robert, Henry was sent to help quash a rebellion in Rouen. One of the leaders was a burgess of the city named Conan. After the rebellion was put down, Duke Robert was inclined to grant mercy to the rebels. But Henry personally took Conan up to the Tower of Rouen and had him thrown to his death. Some accounts say he actually pushed him himself. So Henry was a pretty serious man, and he needed to be, because his big brother was back in town. Robert Curthose briefly invaded England, but Robert always had trouble following through. And Henry managed to buy him off. He promised him an annuity as a kind of a compensation for giving up his claim to the English throne. But this was all about Henry buying time, because he had decided that he, not Robert, was going to be the brother who reunited their father's legacy. In 1106, Henry invaded Normandy. The invasion is the culmination of years of scheming and planning. Henry had been busily suborning Robert's followers, promising them a little land here, a little money there, and this softens up the ground for the final assault. And Robert seems to have been having a lot of trouble readjusting to ruling Normandy after the Crusade. He just never got a handle on the internal politics of Normandy after he got back. And that left the door open for Henry to meddle. So finally, in 1106, King Henry's army attacks Robert at the castle of Tinchebrai in southwestern Normandy. Robert is captured in the battle by the king's chancellor, Waldric. Waldric's not even a knight, he's a cleric, and this is deeply humiliating for a warrior of Robert's reputation. And Robert is held captive by his brother for the next 28 years until he dies in 1134. Now Henry has no serious rival for his hold on the English crown. He does have to fight repeatedly to protect his lands in Normandy, though. And this is especially true later in his reign, because Robert Curthose had a son named William Clito, and when William Clito grew up, he challenged his uncle for control of Normandy. But through a combination of sheer determination, hard work, and good luck, Henry I does manage to hold on to all of the inheritance of William the Conqueror. Ruthlessness pays. Now, this is a very interesting story, of course. Henry's a very intriguing personality, but why does it all matter for English history? It matters because of what Henry manages to accomplish when he isn't putting down Norman rebellions or begetting illegitimate children. His nickname is the Lion of Justice, and most historians give him credit for being something of an administrative pioneer. He did a lot of things, or rather, he got other people to do a lot of things that made England easier to govern. Now, one of the areas where he's on the whole successful is in his relations with the church. He gets St. Anselm, the Archbishop of Canterbury, to come back from exile to perform his wedding ceremony, but then in 1103, Anselm does go into exile again, and the issue is lay investiture. Lay investiture refers to the practice of having the ruler, the king, give the ring and staff of office to a bishop. And in the 11th century, the church had started criticizing this practice because they thought it made church leaders too dependent on secular authorities. Rulers, though, they liked lay investiture because they wanted bishops to be men that they could influence. So Anselm had defied King Henry on the question of investitures. The king had fought back. But finally, in 1107, they reach a compromise, and King Henry officially renounces the right to investiture with the understanding that, in practice, he's still going to have a lot of say in who the bishops were. Now, the investiture issue was a problem in other countries in Europe as well. It was worst in Germany. And there, it took until 1122 to come up with a compromise, and that compromise looks quite a bit like the one that Henry agrees to in 1107. So Henry's actually ahead of his time in straightening out this issue with the church. And he also presides over church councils to try to crack down on clerical marriage. There was quite a lot of pushback on this from the priests concerned. They don't want to give up clerical marriage. And it took a while to make any headway, but Henry did feel as if he was doing his duty and helping to set the church's house in order. And apparently his own personal morality doesn't lead him to have a tolerant view of clerical sins of the flesh. But really, what Henry is best known for are the administrative advances that occurred during his reign. For example, he reorganized the royal household to make it more efficient, more cost-effective, to use a modern concept. And we actually have an account of this reformed royal household that was drawn up shortly after his death. The household apparently consisted of 150 men divided up into various departments. The chamber, the pantry, you know, the various food departments. Plus there were 50 more men who were solely responsible for the hunt. And there was one woman in the royal household, the laundress. And one hopes that she had help doing laundry for 200 men. The most famous advance, though, is the development of the exchequer, and this is the auditing department of the treasury. It allowed the English kings to keep much better track of their revenues than any other contemporary European monarch. This is how it worked. Twice a year, the sheriffs of all the English shires would account for the royal income from various sources that was paid into them in that shire. And they would appear before a group of auditors where the exchequer was meeting, and eventually it became fixed at Westminster. But the accounting took a particular form. A checkered cloth, this is where we get the name exchequer from, a checkered cloth would be spread out on a table, divided into columns, denoting different amounts of money, and it was sort of like an abacus made out of cloth. Each amount of money to be entered for that county, each sum that had been paid in to that sheriff, would be represented by markers placed in the various columns. And these columns were set up according to the decimal system, which had come in recently from the Arab world. Once the amounts were totaled up, they would be entered on long rolls of parchment, known as pipe rolls, because they would be sewn end to end and rolled up into pipes. And these pipe rolls are precious sources for historians. They actually tell us in precise detail how much money the king took in particular years. Unfortunately, most of the early pipe rolls have been lost. We just have one pipe roll that survives from Henry I's reign, the one for 1130, but it doesn't look like it's the first one. We have references to the exchequer that date at least as far back as 1110 or so. It may have been created even earlier. Now, we don't know exactly who created the exchequer, but it was probably the brainchild of one of Henry's crack administrators, and he liked to find talent. He got some flack, in fact, for promoting men in his service who didn't necessarily come from the most socially prominent backgrounds. It was said that he had raised men from the dust, and this was remarked on in wonder, and it was not necessarily something people admired. But he had a nose for people who were going to be serious about their tasks and who would devote themselves to his service. For example, there's a story about how he recruited the most trusted of his advisors, Roger, Bishop of Salisbury. And this happened way back when Henry was still just the younger brother of a king with some lands in western Normandy. Now, at that point, Roger is just a rather humble cleric in Avranches in western Normandy, and Henry happens to pass by his church when Roger is saying Mass. And Henry is very impressed at the rather fast clip at which Roger is getting through the service. And he decides this is an army chaplain. So he takes Roger into his service. Roger rises through the ranks, and by the time of King Henry's death in 1135, Roger is probably the second most powerful man in England. The story about the mass is a later story. Maybe it's not wholly reliable, but I think it does say something about Henry. He valued efficiency. He was all business. And what a busy king he was. Kings in this period had to be tremendously energetic if they were going to keep their jobs, because you really did have to show up in person periodically to keep your nobles in line. You don't want them forgetting you're there. But Henry got a lot of administrative work done despite his very heavy travel schedule. I've mentioned writs several times. These are the informal administrative orders that would be written on strips or scraps of parchment, and they would be directed at individuals or classes of individuals. They might be directed at the sheriff of a particular shire or sometimes to all the king's faithful men. Usually, writs asked people to do something that the king wanted done, and these writs dated well back into the Anglo-Saxon period. William the Conqueror had adopted the practice of sending out writs, but he, as we saw, had changed the language of the writs from Old English to Latin. But the number of writs issued during the reign of Henry I jumps substantially. There are over 1,500 writs that survive from his reign. Probably many more have been lost. And as I've said, they're fairly ephemeral documents, but it helps that they're written on parchment. Parchment is a very durable material. Now, Henry's writs cover an enormous range of topics. Many of them have to do with essentially private concerns of the king, for example. There's a writ that confirms a grant of land that the king made to the Church of Holy Trinity Aldgate in London, for the repose of the soul of his wife, Matilda. But other writs could have to do with pretty important administrative matters. For example, there's a writ from 1108 addressed to the Bishop of Worcester and to the very powerful Sheriff of Worcester, Urs Dabito. That's one of my favorite Norman names, Urs Dabito. And the writ told the bishop and sheriff that they should hold the shire and hundred courts at the same intervals and in the same locations as had been the case under King Edward the Confessor. Now, what's going on here? Apparently, the sheriff had been holding courts more frequently than before, doubtless to collect more revenues from fines, and he had been holding them at places that suited himself, rather than places that the community of the shire was used to. So King Henry was cracking down on that. But many, many of these writs have to do with private land transactions. People are appealing to the king to settle disputes, just as they did under the Anglo-Saxon kings. This is not a very systematic process. Often the party who gets to the king first gets the writ, and there's plenty of favoritism involved at every level. Still, this enormous mass of writs, I think, does testify to Henry's appetite for administration. I think he liked his job. But despite all these administrative achievements, Henry is limited in what he can do to keep track of his subordinates. We've already seen in the case of Urs Dabito, the sheriff of Worcester, who's holding courts to suit himself. I want to talk about two instances of the king's servants not exactly following his orders to the letter. In 1129, Henry had to replace a lot of his sheriffs when it became clear that they were robbing him blind and oppressing their charges. The Exchequer audit could reveal this sort of abuse after the fact, but it couldn't necessarily stop it from happening in the first place. But the most notorious episode of royal servants going rogue took place in 1124, and it's interesting because it plays up the tensions between Henry the Administrator and Henry the Warrior King. Henry at this point is dealing with yet another rebellion in Normandy, and it's a pretty serious one. He has a lot of troops in the field, he needs to pay them, and he has masses of silver coins shipped over from England in order to pay the troops. But when the coins arrive, it is discovered that they are seriously debased. That is, their silver content is less than it should have been. Clearly, the English moneyers are keeping some of the silver for themselves, and the soldiers complain. And the king is so furious that he sends an order to Bishop Roger. He's the one who can say mass so quickly. An order to Bishop Roger that all the moneyers in England should be deprived of their right hands and their genitals. And the moneyers were duly summoned to Winchester and mutilated. I think we can draw a couple of lessons from this rather gruesome episode. First, Henry has an administration that's efficient enough to carry out this sentence. The king really does have a long reach. But second, his administration is not efficient enough to stop the moneyers from cheating in the first place. So there are limits to how effectively the king can control his subordinates. And the third lesson to draw from the moneyers episode is that the whole thing came about because the king needed money for a war. We need to remember that Henry is almost always multitasking. He's in the field defending his lands in France, trying to keep a handle on the government of England at the same time. And certainly without men like Roger of Salisbury, he couldn't possibly have pulled it off. But you do have to give Henry credit for picking Roger out of that little church in Avranches. So what are we to make of the Lion of Justice? He got a mixed press at the time. On the good side, there's a notice about Henry in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, a notice that praises Henry for providing law and order. It says, "In his time, no man dared do wrong against another. He made peace for man and beast. No man dared say anything but good to whoever carried their load of gold or silver." So that sounds great. But we hear other voices too, voices that suggest that Henry's justice could seem oppressive and maybe even arbitrary. In the Worcester Chronicle, we have an account that supposedly records three nightmares that Henry had. Apparently, he's assaulted in his dreams by members of the so-called three orders of society, the peasants, the knights, the clerics. In the first vision, the peasants appear brandishing their pitchforks. In the second nightmare, the king sees fully armed knights who want to kill him. And in the third, there are prelates holding their pastoral staves, and clearly they're planning to turn them against the king. And the point of the nightmares is obviously that the king has oppressed every element of society. So not everybody thinks that the long reach of Henry I is a good thing. But there's a reason why the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle waxes nostalgic about Henry's reign. It's going to seem really good in comparison with what came later. And we'll find out what happened after Henry died in our next lecture.
Lecture 15, The Anarchy of Stephen's Reign.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we talked about the reign of Henry I, the Lion of Justice. And we saw that Henry did a lot to improve the efficiency of the English government, including establishing the Exchequer, which is really the most sophisticated financial body in Christian Europe at the time. But we also saw that there's possibly a downside to Henry's love of law and order. He could act rather arbitrarily, and he could be quite cruel when he felt that he needed to set an example. But I also said that he was remembered with respect, and that this fact has a lot to do with what came after Henry I. Because compared to the next reign in English history, Henry I's reign is definitely going to seem like the good old days. The problem all came about because when Henry I died in 1135, the question of who would succeed him was far from clear. And the answer to this question mattered a lot because England needed a strong king. The state that had grown up in England under the Wessex monarchs in the 10th century was centered on a strong monarchy. And after the Norman conquest, again, the Norman kings have further reinforced this royal rule. The king is the source of justice. He's the source of patronage. You need the king to be the right sort of man for the job. I think Robert Curthose never succeeded at becoming king of England because, in a real sense, people grasped that he wasn't the right sort of man for the job, whereas his two brothers, William Rufus and Henry I, they were the right sort. They had the right combination of intelligence and energy and ruthlessness to get the job done. So you needed the right man. And there were two major problems that could arise under this system. You might end up with the wrong man. That had been the case with Æthelred the Unready, and the kingdom certainly suffered as a result. Or, and this could be worse, you might end up not knowing clearly who the right man is, and this had happened in 1066. And in both of these situations, England ended up being conquered, first by the Danes, then by the Normans. So you need the right man. But what if you aren't sure who that is? Or what if the right man turns out instead to be a woman. And I'll explain why I ask that question in a moment. The crisis that occurred after Henry I died goes back to an event that happened in 1120. And in order to explain that event, we need to go back to Henry I and his numerous progeny. In the last lecture, I talked about Henry's proclivity for engendering illegitimate children. Unfortunately, he was not nearly as prolific with his own wife, Queen Matilda. Matilda gave birth to 2, possibly 3 children, but only 2 lived to adulthood. These were a daughter, Matilda, another Matilda, and a son, William. And the young Princess Matilda was sent off to Germany at the age of 10 to marry Emperor Henry V. And as a result, Matilda was always known as the Empress, even after she was widowed and remarried. More about that to come. Just keep in mind that this title, Empress, means a great deal to her. Now, Prince William, he's called William Atheling to play up his English heritage. This is definitely part of playing to the crowd on King Henry's part. Prince William receives the typical upbringing of a royal youth, rather heavy on the martial training and the partying. And unfortunately, William was a bit too fond of partying, and this led to one of the most important dynastic catastrophes in English history. In November of 1120, King Henry had just wrapped up a rather successful campaign in Normandy. He was ready to head back to England, and he was traveling with his entourage, including his son Prince William and several of his other children, of his illegitimate children. Now, on November 25th, the king is in the harbor town of Barfleur, waiting to cross the channel, when a man named Thomas, son of Stephen, approaches King Henry and tells him that his father Stephen had carried Henry's father, William the Conqueror, over to England in 1066 in his ship. And Thomas, son of Stephen, wants the privilege of performing the same service his father had done. And he says he has an excellent vessel known as the White Ship ready at hand. Now, King Henry replies he'd already arranged a ship for himself, but he'd be glad if Thomas would carry his son William and his noble companions, including another son and daughter. Take them in the White Ship. Now, this is good enough for Thomas. And when his sailors hear that they're going to be carrying the king's son to England, they rejoice, and they ask William Atheling to supply them with a drink, which he does, apparently, quite readily and in great abundance. Now, the ship is planning to set out late at night because that's the most advantageous time to navigate because you can take advantage of the pole star. But unfortunately, this allows more time for the party to continue. About 300 people had crowded aboard the ship, including some marine guards who were already drunk and showing off. Priests arrived to bless the guards, but the guards laugh at the priests and drive them away. Some people on board sense that things are getting out of hand, and they actually disembark. Now, one of the men who gets off isn't so much struck by prudence as by a bad case of diarrhea. His name is Stephen, Count of Mortain, and he is King Henry's nephew. And we will encounter Stephen again later in the lecture. Anyway, the ship finally sets sail with a very raucous party going on. And as the ship is working up out of the harbor, obviously the steersman isn't paying very close attention, it hits a rock and 2 planks are split open. And the ship starts to sink. Now, a boat is launched, carrying the prince, but he turns back to the ship to try to save his half-sister, who is about to drown. And only one man of all of the 300 people on board the ship survive. And the body of Prince William is never found. Meanwhile, King Henry's ship has made it safely to England. And when the dreadful news is broken to the king, he's said to have fallen to the ground with grief. He had to be helped to a private room to recover. The heir to the English throne has died in a drunken sailing accident. So what's King Henry going to do now? If it had been 100 years earlier, he might have been able to get the English to accept one of his illegitimate sons as his heir. This had worked fine for William the Conqueror, William the Bastard, you'll remember. But already at that time, it had been getting tricky, and by the early 12th century, it simply wasn't going to fly. The church had managed to push through the notion that kings have to be legitimately born. And this was a pity, in a sense, because Henry did have a very able, very talented illegitimate son named Robert, Earl of Gloucester. He would probably have made a fine king, but that was not an option. So Henry's first response is to try to beget another legitimate son. His wife, Queen Matilda, had died in 1118, so he's free to marry again. And just a few months after the wreck of the White Ship, that's exactly what he does. He marries a woman called Adeliza of Louvain, whose father has important lands in the Low Countries. But unfortunately, the marriage is childless. Now what? Well, Henry did have other male members of the family, other legitimately born males he could turn to. Probably the most obvious choice would have been Stephen, Count of Mortain, the one who got off the White Ship because of an attack of the Runs. Stephen is the king's nephew. He's the son of the king's sister, Adela, the Countess of Blois and Champagne. Stephen was a royal favorite. King Henry showered him with estates and other good things, and it might have made sense to build Stephen up as a potential successor, and certainly Stephen seems to have considered this possibility. Maybe even in the early 1120s, that might have been what Henry was actually planning. And if not Stephen, then Stephen had brothers, perhaps one of them. But that's not what Henry did in the end. Because in 1125, his daughter Matilda, the Empress of Germany, was widowed, which meant she was available again. Now, father and daughter had always kept in touch. They'd even found opportunities to meet up several times when Henry was on the continent. And now Henry summoned Matilda home. His plan clearly was that Matilda will marry again and produce the male heir that he, King Henry, has been unable to produce. He's hoping to be succeeded by a grandson rather than a son. So he marries Matilda off a second time to Geoffrey, the son of the Count of Anjou. And he makes his barons swear to support Matilda as his heir. Now, this was a very unpopular move among the barons, both in Normandy and in England. For one thing, kings are supposed to be men. It's virtually unprecedented for a female to rule in Western Europe. Another problem is Matilda's husband. Anjou, the homeland of Matilda's new husband, is a very important territory. Anjou and Normandy had been rivals for years, and there is certainly bad feeling between the Angevin and Norman lords. These lords don't want to end up taking orders from the Count of Anjou. Of course, they're assuming that Matilda will be ruling as a figurehead, and that the real power is going to be wielded by her husband, the Count. They obviously don't know Matilda very well. Matilda is not the sort of woman who is going to submit meekly to her husband. She and Geoffrey have a fairly stormy marriage, and at one point early on, they're actually separated for a considerable time, and they have to be cajoled, not to say coerced, into reconciling. The Pope even has to get involved. Matilda clearly considers that for a former empress, marriage to a mere Count of Anjou is beneath her. They don't get along. Still, they're both ambitious people, and I think they realize that it's vital to keep on King Henry's good side, so they do their duty, and they produce three sons. And after that, Matilda and Geoffrey seem to have seen each other very rarely. King Henry, however, is delighted by the birth of his grandsons and positively dotes on them. As I said, Matilda and her husband Geoffrey are ambitious people, and Matilda ended up acting like any other adult royal child who isn't being given enough power or responsibility to keep her busy. And we saw this problem already with Robert Curthose and William the Conqueror, and we'll see it again. You've got a prince or a princess who wants more headroom than the king is willing to give. Now, King Henry had promised certain fortresses on the Norman-Angevin border as part of Matilda's dowry. But he had been very slow to hand them over. Kings really hate letting go of any of their power. At least English kings did. And this angered Matilda and Geoffrey. And it's one of the few times where they actually were on the same page. So they were actually in rebellion against Henry I in the fall of 1135 when the king suddenly fell ill. So they're in rebellion. They're not on the spot when he dies. Now, Henry's death is another less than dignified royal death, although it's not nearly as repulsive as William the Conqueror's. He's in Normandy, in the northeastern part of the duchy, and he had been hunting. As I've said before, all English kings love to hunt. So after a long day of hunting, he sits down to supper, and he eats a dish of lampreys, which are a kind of eel, apparently a very large dish of lampreys. His doctors had warned him against this. Apparently, lampreys disagreed with him. But the king didn't listen, and 3 days later, he was dead, as the saying goes, of a surfeit of eels. So Henry I is dead. Matilda is supposed to succeed him. But that's not what happened, because once again we have the importance of being the man or woman on the spot. At the time Henry died, Matilda was in Anjou. She quickly crossed the border into Normandy, and finally she did take charge of those border castles that have been causing all the trouble between her and her father. But she's not close to England. Almost out of the blue comes a wild card, King Henry's nephew, Stephen, Count of Mortain, who by now is known as Stephen of Blois. He's just across the channel from England, in the county of Boulogne. And as soon as Stephen hears of the death of his uncle the king, he jumps on board a ship, sails to England as fast as he can, and he seizes the treasury at Winchester, just exactly the way Henry I himself had done back in 1100 when his brother William Rufus was killed in the New Forest. And on December 22nd, 1135, Stephen was crowned King of England by the Archbishop of Canterbury. He had to promise all sorts of things to the church to get their approval for this. After all, people are violating an oath that they swore to support Matilda, and the church has to get them out of this. It's definitely a quid pro quo arrangement. Meanwhile, in Normandy, the nobles there are trying to figure out what to do. They don't want Matilda, or even worse, her husband, ruling Normandy. He's an Angevin, which is bad. She's a woman, which is worse. So they're just on the verge of actually offering the Duchy of Normandy to Stephen's older brother, Theobald, when word arrives that Stephen has been crowned king in England. And at that point, the nobles in Normandy decide it's better to have one lord rather than two. And they doubtless remember how much of a problem it was during the whole conflict between Robert Curthose and his brothers when Normandy and England were ruled by different people. So the Norman nobles go ahead, they accept Stephen as Duke of Normandy as well as King of England. And that's where it stood for the next 3 years. Matilda has been cheated out of her inheritance. But she doesn't feel quite strong enough yet to act. Most nobles in England and Normandy had accepted the fait accompli of Stephen's coronation. Even Matilda's strongest supporter, her half-brother, Robert, Earl of Gloucester, had sworn allegiance to King Stephen. But either the Earl of Gloucester was just biding his time, or he got fed up with King Stephen's policies in Normandy. And so in 1138, Robert, Earl of Gloucester, rebels in his sister's behalf. He renounces his fealty to King Stephen and proclaims that he is going to try to put Matilda in her rightful place on the English throne. And in addition, at the same time, the King of Scotland, who is Matilda's uncle, also invaded England. Now remember, Matilda's mother is Matilda of Scotland. King David of Scotland is her younger brother, so he is Matilda's uncle. Now, this first rebellion fizzles out fairly quickly. The Scots are beaten decisively at the Battle of the Standard in Yorkshire. Now, I want to pause to talk about this battle for a moment because it's interesting from a number of perspectives. First, it's interesting how the battle got its name, the Battle of the Standard. Apparently, the English army had a large pole or standard, and they carried it before them with a banner on it. And on the banner were the images of several saints, including Saint Wilfrid. St. Wilfrid was the bishop who had argued at the Synod of Whitby in 664 in favor of going over to the Roman date of Easter. So at this battle in 1138, the English army is commemorating this very important turning point in the history of England. In addition, we have an account of the battle in which the English army is treated to a very intriguing pep talk right before they go off to fight. They're told that they have a chance now to build on the triumphs of their ancestors. And the triumphs that they hear about, that they're supposed to imitate, are the Norman conquests, not just of England, but of Sicily and of Jerusalem. These are areas that Normans had also conquered. There's a sense here in which already, at the Battle of the Standard in 1138, English and Norman are becoming one people. Our pasts are merging. The final point to make about the battle, though, is a very practical one. You get a sense of how serious the threat from Scotland is throughout the period covered by our course. Yorkshire may seem like a long way north from London, but it's actually fairly far south into English territory from Scotland. So northern England has to worry about Scotland a lot. Not so much being conquered by Scotland. Scotland doesn't really have the resources for that. But raiding is a very serious problem. And if Scottish raiders come and steal your livestock and burn your farmhouse, it doesn't much matter whether they're there to stay or not. But on this occasion, the English win, the Scots go home, and King Stephen breathes a temporary sigh of relief. But it's only temporary, because things are about to get really bad. In the spring of 1139, a faction fight splits the king's court. Now, this sort of thing had happened before in English history. It had really haunted the whole of King Athelred's reign, and we'll see it again. There were two factions at Stephen's court. One was led by Roger, Bishop of Salisbury. He's essentially the head of the royal administration. He's a holdover from Henry I's reign. The other faction is led by a pair of twins known as the Beaumonts, Walleran, Count of Moulins, and Robert, Earl of Leicester. And it's a vicious behind-the-scenes battle. It ends up with the Beaumonts managing to provoke some of the followers of Bishop Roger into drawing their weapons at court. And this is a breach of the king's peace, a very serious offense. Bishop Roger is arrested, as are two of his nephews, who were also bishops. Now, these bishops have important responsibilities in the administration. One of the nephews, Nigel of Ely, is the treasurer. And when Stephen broke these bishops, he was crippling his own administration. And what was worse, he was opening an avenue for his enemies to attack. Here's how. I mentioned earlier in this lecture that Stephen had brothers. One of them is Count Theobald, the brother who is shunted aside as Duke of Normandy when the Norman nobles decide that they want to follow just one lord. But there's another brother, a very interesting man named Henry. And I'm sorry that it's another Henry. Henry is Bishop of Winchester, and this is probably the second most important job in the English Church after Archbishop of Canterbury. Technically, the Archbishop of York outranks the Bishop of Winchester, but the See of Winchester is much richer than York, and it's right in the heart of political events in the kingdom. Plus, Henry of Winchester is a papal legate, which means he has powers delegated to him by the Pope to settle certain questions on the spot in England on the Pope's behalf. And even though Henry is the king's brother, he definitely has his own agenda, and he doesn't like the way that his brother, the king, had treated his bishops. Henry's a bishop himself. And so the arrest of the bishops in 1139 opens the way for Henry of Winchester to change sides. And it's about to get interesting. On September 30th, 1139, a group of ships arrives from Normandy, and on board are the Empress Matilda and Robert, Earl of Gloucester. Now, somebody who's not there is Geoffrey, Count of Anjou. He never comes to England. England is really his wife's thing. He concentrates on getting control of Normandy, and after many years of fighting, he actually does that. So Matilda and Robert land on the Sussex coast near the castle of Arundel, which is held by Adeliza of Louvain, the Empress's stepmother, the widow of Henry I, and apparently Matilda and Adeliza had always gotten along. Shortly before, another group of the Empress's supporters had landed farther to the west, and thus they created a sort of a diversion. So Robert of Gloucester took the opportunity to escape to the west, to Bristol, in the heart of his own lands, And this left the Empress in Arundel Castle, and it put King Stephen in a very difficult position. Here, Matilda's gender may have worked in her favor for once. Stephen already looks bad after arresting three bishops the year before. Now, if he arrests a woman, his own cousin, how's that going to look? Even more important, Queen Adeliza is now married to one of his chief supporters. He doesn't want to cause offense either by arresting somebody who was under Queen Adeliza's protection or by arresting a woman. So the king grants Matilda a safe conduct to Bristol, and his own brother, Henry, Bishop of Winchester, acts as escort. Now, Henry is going to switch back and forth between his brother and the Empress during the course of the next few years. It's now time to fight a civil war. We have two claimants to the English throne on the loose: Stephen, the anointed king, the man on the spot, and Matilda, the designated heir, the one King Henry I had wanted to succeed him. Each of them had strengths and weaknesses. Stephen was hard to figure out. He was very personally brave, but he didn't always make the right strategic decisions. He often ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he wasn't a very good politician. He seriously mishandled his very difficult brother, Henry, for example. His contemporaries really didn't see him as all that king-like, and you can compare, for example, what the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says about him to what it says about Henry I. Remember, Henry I provided justice and peace. You were scared of Henry. But about Stephen, the Chronicle says, he was a mild man and gentle and good and did no justice. That's not very complimentary for a king. On the other hand, Matilda had something of the opposite problem. She was haughty to the point of arrogance. And we can start with the fact that she insisted on being called Empress all the time. This arrogance was going to get her into serious trouble, as we will see. So how does the Civil War play out in the field? I'm just going to give you the highlights because a lot of the war is a grind. It drags on for years. There were minor skirmishes and sieges, mostly concentrated in a few disputed areas, especially eastern England in the Fen country and also in the Midlands in the area around Oxford. Most of the rest of the country is relatively untouched by the fighting because it's securely held by one faction or the other. The Angevins, the supporters of Matilda, they have a very secure foothold in the west because Robert of Gloucester has huge estates there. The supporters of King Stephen are really unchallenged in the southeast. So most of the fighting is fairly localized. That being said, some of the episodes of fighting are very dramatic, so I'll run through these in turn. The first one I want to mention is the Battle of Lincoln on February 2nd, 1141. This battle is important for a few reasons, but one, I think, is that it illustrates how readily some of the nobles in England changed sides. King Stephen had offended a pair of brothers, Ranulf, Earl of Chester, and William, Earl of Rumar. But they kept their displeasure under wraps. The two earls sent their wives to the castle at Lincoln, ostensibly on the pretext that they were visiting the wife of the castellan, the man in charge of the castle. Then Ranulf, Earl of Chester, showed up, unarmed, claiming he's just joining his wife, who's already inside. But once he's inside, the earl and his man attack the garrison, they seize weapons, his brother, the Earl of Rumar, breaks in too, and together they seize the castle. Now, when King Stephen hears about this, he hurries north to besiege the castle. The Earl of Chester escapes. He joins forces with Robert, Earl of Gloucester, and together they besiege the besiegers. So now King Stephen is pinned between the castle and the army of the Angevins. Stephen decides to try to fight his way out, but in the battle, he is captured. Now, this is obviously a terrible blow. For the moment, the Angevins are triumphant. But they reckoned without Empress Matilda's chief personality flaw. Matilda figures that now that Stephen's in captivity, she's a shoo-in to be queen. So she goes off to London in high state, expecting to be crowned. But she makes several major mistakes. After very complicated, very protracted negotiations, she enters Westminster. But she makes the mistake of being very arrogant and high-handed in her treatment of Henry, Bishop of Winchester, who had come over to her side. Henry was her ticket to getting the church to cooperate in her coronation, and that's crucial. While she's waiting to be crowned, she interferes in the election of the Bishop of Durham. And this offends Bishop Henry. He's the papal legate. This should have been his thing to decide. And this is the beginning of Henry's decision to change sides and revert to supporting his brother. Worse still, Matilda offended the Londoners. They petitioned her politely for a reduction in the financial demands placed on them by the crown. Certainly they're thinking, here's our chance to get a better deal. But instead of just saying, I'm afraid we can't really do that right now. You see, the circumstances aren't favorable. We are fighting a war of survival, or something tactful like that. Matilda demands even more money from the Londoners. They are enraged, and they drive her out of the city. She has to flee to Oxford, and one contemporary source describes the retreat as a rout. So in the summer of 1141, she advances to Winchester to try to coerce Bishop Henry, who is now prevaricating about who he's going to support. While Matilda's forces are besieging the bishop, a force of Stephen's supporters comes up from London and attacks the Empress, and she only just escapes, but at a terrible cost. Robert, Earl of Gloucester, is covering her retreat, and he is captured. So now each of the two sides in the Civil War is down one major figure, and after much hemming and hawing, the inevitable happens. King Stephen is exchanged for Robert, Earl of Gloucester, and the fighting continues. Nothing much gained on either side. I just want to talk briefly about one final military exploit of the Civil War, because it captures a little bit of how personally brave Matilda was. After the disaster at Winchester, Stephen was at liberty, and he besieges Matilda in Oxford, and she's in desperate straits, and she needs to escape. It's winter. The Thames River, which flows through Oxford, was frozen. Matilda and a small escort of 3 or 4 knights slip out of the castle wearing white cloaks to disguise themselves against the snowy landscape. They walk 7 or 8 miles through the snow in the dead of night to Abingdon. And then Matilda makes her way west to the Castle of Devizes, where she tries for the next 6 years to make headway against King Stephen. But she never becomes queen. So what are we to make of this period of civil war? Historians argue a lot about it. Some think it was a period of anarchy in England. They take their cue from some of the chronicles of the time, especially the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. It comes to an end in this period with a very long, rambling description of the civil war. It has nothing good to say about it. And in this entry, the chronicle says that the reign of Stephen was a time when Christ and his saints slept. But other historians point out that a lot of functions of government seem to have carried on as normal. Shire courts are meeting, coins are minted, admittedly some by Stephen, some by Matilda. Charters are granted, again, by both Stephen and Matilda. If you're not in one of the areas most affected by the fighting, maybe it's not so bad. As is often the case, I think the truth lies somewhere in between. Things in England were undoubtedly worse in some places than in others, but England had become used to peace and prosperity under the Norman kings. That's not really what they get under Stephen. And that's why he's one of only 2 kings in English history never to have a successor named after him. There's never been a Stephen II. And Matilda never gets to be queen at all. But she won in the end because her son did get to be king. And we'll find out how in the next lecture.
Lecture 16, Henry II, Law and Order.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we talked about the so-called anarchy of Stephen's reign. And we saw that for much of the reign, the rule of England was contested between 2 parties, the Angevin party, led by the Empress Matilda, daughter of Henry I, and the royal party, led by King Stephen. Toward the end of the reign, though, both sides became essentially exhausted, and Matilda gave up her claim to the throne in favor of her oldest son, Henry. I think she bowed to the inevitable facts of gender politics in the 12th century. It was just going to be a whole lot easier for people to accept a man as ruler, even if he was a young man, barely out of his teens. Now, young Prince Henry did in fact make several forays into England from Normandy in the 1140s and the early 1150s, sort of ways of testing the water. But his most important effort began in 1153. He came with the intention of defeating King Stephen in battle, but this proved impossible. Nevertheless, Henry was slowly gaining supporters. He was, after all, the grandson of Henry I. And by this point, Henry I was being remembered quite fondly. He's somebody who at least